Hey guys, I'm grateful for you being here this afternoon, and I think this is our last session, isn't it? So, you know, the old thing is I'm the thing standing between you and lunch. I guess I'm the one standing between you, us and dinner, and end of the day, but I'm really, truly grateful you're here. My name is Sean Pierce, and I think I introduced on the stage, so or the platform earlier, and I'm a co-vocational, I would say, by choice. Have two ministries. I lead our local association in Albany, New York, our state capital, New York State, kind of the one city. Everybody's heard of Syracuse and Buffalo and Rochester, and Albany's the fourth one outside of the city that gets ignored, neglected in many ways, but that's where we are in the bigger region. And then I also lead one of the churches there as well. And so I'm really excited to talk today because I'm really passionate about both. And I bump into people along the way. They're like, well, how could you do that? Like, you know, how could you just not pastor, or how could you pastor and not be an AMS? And I would say I'm one of those rare guys that I love both. I would die if I couldn't pastor. I was a full-time association missionary for 10 years, and God gave me grace. I was pastoring, and I swallowed hard, really felt like serving in that role was kind of the last thing that I wanted to do, because I had a false conception of what this role is. And God just kind of shut my pastoring heart off, as strange as it is, and I didn't miss it for years, and then all of a sudden the faucet turned on again, and I would really struggle to not pastor. Like I love it, but I would really struggle to be just a pastor. I'm careful how I say that, because pastoring is phenomenal, and I would certainly put lots of asterisks and disclaimers saying that in front of my own guys in our association. But I love the responsibility, the opportunity, the ability to network and work and think and dream and pray and influence a bigger region than just what my community and the church where I lead is. So I love both. And because of that, I don't know how long bivocational has been around. I didn't do ChatGPT to ask where that came about. And I'm not even sure if that originated in a ministry world or not. Maybe that's a ministry term. Some of you guys might know better than me. Co-vocational has been around for, what, 5 years, 10 years? Not 10, I don't know. And I'm not sure what that means to everybody. For me, I like the term co-vocational because for most folks, it gives me a reason to explain and talk about it instead of saying I know what bivocational is about. And the difference between the two is either I get to or I got to. Bivocational is you got to, because you got no other choice, just the financial constraints or whatever, and that's the nature of the beast, and you do it or you don't. You know, you move on. Co-vocational is you get to. And it's a by choice. I could be, because of where our church is financially and the association that I lead, there are about 30 churches in our association. Most of them have been planted within the last 20 years. I could actually be full-time both sides. Our giving from those churches is significant enough in our association. I wouldn't be just eating ramen noodles and whatever. Like, we could legitimately do very well at that. But we've made the strategic choice for the kingdom to be co-vocational, and I see myself doing that till I retire. In fact, I think when I became pastoring the church again, they kind of said, so how long do you be full-time? I said, oh, I don't see this for a long time. I'd rather have three or four part-time guys working together long before, like, the goal is not to somehow for me to be full-time. So I very much come in our conversation today. I do want this to be conversational, so I'm recording this. I don't know if the recording's going to come through, but I think this is a topic that needs conversation, and unashamedly, I'm hoping to influence and change the conversation. So I'm coming at you with Sean Pierce-isms. I'm coming at you with New York, my experiences. I didn't use ChatGPT or read the latest book to say, yeah, what should I talk about with how to thrive as a bivocational or co-vocational guy? I'm giving you my experiences that come out of my context, who I am, and I'm hoping we can leverage the strengths in the room. But I also think there's a lot of principles that'll come out that may need to be shifted or put into your context. And I think the conversation truly needs to change. And hopefully as we talk, I feel like everybody knows that bivocationalism seems to be increasing. You know, it's not going down, it's coming up, usually out of necessity, I think, and at least what I'm hearing in most places. But there is a segment of it that's happening that there's a lot of quality leaders that are choosing to be co-vocational or bivocational as well, that are phenomenal. And I think some of our biggest kingdom impact changes and growth changes comes out of that kind of crowd. And so that's why I'm trying to invest in a conversation that needs to shift, rather than how do we help these poor, you know, struggling guys or their ministries, is more of, hey, what are the real benefits and the strengths? And there's some phenomenal things that are happening in that world by guys who are very capable leaders that are doing well. So I was still in seminary, and I was, I don't know if it was trivocational, quadrivocational. I got married. I started seminary a week later because I didn't want to move from Maine to New York without a woman, my wife, and start seminary. And within 2 years, within a year, I was kind of restarting a failed church plant with one family, which I don't recommend. I don't even know what you call that today. You know, established churches, you call it replanting. Probably it's just stupid is probably what the true thing is. And I picked it up from the planter that had moved on. And I was a new father, seminary student, working for the town offices in the town of Bennington and trying to restart a church plant. And I had more than my hands full at the ripe age of 23 and 24, if you got the picture. I was bivocational because I had to, because that church plant couldn't afford me. And I knew that I was supposed to be there, and I was being faithful to God, and it was hard. But in between there, as I pastored another church and became an AMS over 20 years ago, full-time. The last 11 or 12 years, 13, I lose count. I've stopped kind of mile-marking my life in ministry. I've been pastoring a church and an AMS, and I do it by choice. So I shifted from that bivo role to the co-vocational role, and I think it's just so significant. So kind of maybe to kind of whet our appetites or kind of get oriented a little bit, what are the stereotypes, assumptions that we think about, good or bad? I think there's some are bad, negativisms, if you will. I think there's some positive things too, but just what comes to your mind as you think about bivocational ministry, whether it's for AMS? We're going to talk mostly about bivocational, co-vocational for us, but we're going to bleed into the pastor thing and all of that, because the principles kind of work both ways. But what are some of the stereotypes that you guys think of? There's a bunch that comes to my mind. Most of them are negative, to be honest with you. I'm trying to change the conversation to, hey, I think we need to flip that script, not just for positive thinking, but there's a new opportunity there. But what comes to your mind?
One I have heard is, how do you find time to do everything you have to do?
How do you find time? Too much to do, too little time. Which, by the way, applies to every ministry. Let's be honest, but I guess we double it for bivocational.
How can you be excellent at both?
How in the world could you be? And what happens, we talked about this last time, but what happens when you feel like you're not effective and excellent at both? You either burn out trying to be, or you end up feeling like a failure and you carry the shame and the guilt that you can't be like whatever these other guys are. You know, when I grow up one day and being a big boy or girl, you know, I'm going to be able to be like those guys. Like, there's a lot of baggage in there, self-identity and all of that. So, yeah, what else?
Split commitment. You can't be committed to that and that at the same time. I don't see how that works. I've heard that.
I've heard that from some friends of mine who are AMSs that feel like, well, Sean, if you're pastoring, you're not really fulfilling your calling to be this apostolic, you know, regional entrepreneur guy. And I'm like, wait a minute, we'll talk about that in a minute. I'm like, no, I think I am. Like, I is might not be you, but I feel that way. Yeah, divided. Somebody else.
Jealousy between one or the other. Maybe even in your family, both others.
Jealousy, yeah, even with your family, yeah, it's good. Somebody else?
Treated like second class.
Second class. Who's somebody else say? The JV team, yeah. You're the junior varsity, yeah, second class, yep. Yeah, if you're a really good leader, you could be full-time.
When are you going to be full-time?
When are you going to be full-time? Yeah. You're always trying to achieve that goal, yep. What else?
How do you get to your other churches on Sundays to see your pastors in real time?
We're for sure going to talk about that. How do you get
with their people, not just on the video screen?
Yeah, right? Yeah. Very, very good. Yep. I have one that I didn't throw out in the last session, but I think there's a little bit of a stereotype that the bivocational guys lack education. And the tendency is I get the emails, hey, come, this is good education for bivocational guys. I'm like, half of my association are bivocational guys, and they're all educated. And that's not an area that's really a need. But I think there's an assumption in there. Yeah, absolutely. What else? Dig a little deeper.
I got a positive one.
Throw it out, yeah.
My livelihood is not dependent upon church income, right? Yeah.
Your livelihood, if you've got more than one ministry, so if it's like a secular kind of role as well as a church or ministry, then you've got a second source of income that you're not absolutely subservient to that ministry. That's good. What else? What are some other positive things in there?
They have some other skills they learn elsewhere that are valuable.
They've got some other abilities. They've got some horsepower. Yes. What if they're doing well? How many of you know bivocational ministries are in your association? I presume everybody does, right? Does anybody in the room not have that? Any of you, are any of you bivocational, co-vocational AMSs? Any of you guys? Two or three quasi? I got to know what quasi means.
I teach some college classes a couple of days a week.
Yeah.
I'm full-time AMS.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. So, how many of you would say you see effective, whether it's you or somebody else, but just truly effective co-vocational, bivocational guys? What stands out to you for them? What's the stereotype with that kind of guy? Because that's the piece that I think is missing so much in the conversation today. What do you pick up with them? What do you think of?
I see them surrounding themselves by capable, competent others that they're able to delegate and rely on. They don't think they've got to do it all. And the expectation from the churches is that they do it all.
Mm-hmm. Quality leader. Experienced leader. I'm convinced. I was bivocational early on. I was not a good enough leader to do that well. So the bad stereotypes, I think, did apply to me. Today, I think, because I've grown and shifted, I think to truly do this and thrive, as we're going to talk about, it really takes an experienced, capable leader over time to do that well. Yeah. What else?
They relate to their people better.
They relate to the people better. How so?
Well, you know, if I've got, you know, Joe who works 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week at a factory, I've got I've been working 40, 50 hours a week. It's a different job, but I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finding the extra time, if you will, to do church stuff too.
Mm-hmm. It's, absolutely.
I understand when they say, well, I really can't. Yeah, okay.
There's some sympathy along the way. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, people, you gain some street credibility when the pastor has a real job, if he's pastoring. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was going to piggyback on that. That's true on a bivocational AMS, is you're able to relate, especially to your bivocational pastors in a way.
Yeah.
I, as a full-time AMS, can't relate to my bivocational.
Yeah. It's a practitioner's world, isn't it? We somewhere, I don't know when it shifted, maybe it's always been, I don't know, but, and I'm thinking in the SBC world, but somewhere along the way it shifted to more of a practitioner's world. I think it was along the lines of technology and kind of things, and I've seen in my own association, I gained tremendous street credibility with my guys. In fact, church planners that come in, you know, as I'm coaching them, they'll proactively say, Sean, talk to me about, we're trying to figure out, you know, what's this leadership structure going to look like? How do you do it? How do you equip? Instead of talking in terms of just, you know, what are their general principles, they look and see me on equal terms and equal footing, and it naturally puts me in that world. And so one of the huge benefits, we're kind of bleeding, not just stereotypes, but kind of what are the benefits that we miss a lot of times, is the guy that's bivocational is able to have sympathy and engage differently. You know, because I'm a pastor and Sunday comes around with tremendous regularity and I can't just go preach the sermon that I did every, you know, other, for the last 5 years or whatever in the same churches, I bear all those burdens, and I'm the guy fielding the what do you do when, you know, the young girl's been sexually abused and asking for help, and you don't have other capable, equipable people to turn to. So it creates a lot of sympathy and heart and connection in the middle of that. There's some tremendous benefits to being co-vocational. What are some other things you guys have seen that are beneficial? So I feel like we usually look at it as a glass half empty, and a lot of times it is. But I feel like more and more we need to change the overall conversation, because there are more and more quality leaders that are choosing to do this for a bigger kingdom impact. So what's on the asset side of the balance sheet?
They have more relationships with unchurched.
More relationships with unchurched.
Community.
So like the bivocational pastor, yep, is able to engage for sure. Yep. And they can model those relationships with church members as well. Somebody else.
Well, I don't know if this is what you're thinking about, but being co-vocational, bivocational, is as much a call from the Lord, or at least it should be, as being called to be full-time. If God's not calling you to do it, you don't need to do it.
I think you're right. We're going to talk a little bit. Some of it's a perspective of how to do that, the dividing piece. We're going to shift in just a minute to like what are the success factors, the thriving factors. One of those is shifting our assumptions and our thinking, and that is one of those shifts. But one of the benefits I see is I get to say no more. You know, some leaders aren't as strategic with their time and their focus, and so I'm not dogging those that aren't. And some leaders tend to find more comfortable just to respond kind of to what's going on. But if you're a leader that's trying to lead proactively in some things, you get to pick and choose now. And it's refreshing for people to say, I know you're busy. And I'm like, hey, I'm not too busy for you, but it cuts out a lot of junk, both on the church side and even the association side. And it forces me to be a better leader, because you actually have to grow as a leader when you become co-vocational. You've got to delegate even more. You actually have to think even sharper, crisper, move a little bit faster, and be able to juggle more. And it's an absolute learning curve. There's a shift in there of responsibility along the way. By the way, I realized when I was full-time as an AMS and then pastored again, the shelf life for denominational leaders, in terms of, like, I'm thinking in the pastor denominational leader kind of world, it's a lot shorter than it's ever been, and I would say it's shrinking all the time. And I underestimated, because I had pastored, I would say, fairly healthy, you know, experience, and had a lot of experience with what I was doing, and it was a steeper learning curve moving back into the pastor role, because the world had shifted, and I was hanging in that world, I was living in that world, you know, technology and everything else, but it was still different than when you're sitting in the seat of the lead pastor. And it's still different when you're in that world. And so it really does kind of keep you a little more focused, a little sharper there. Any other benefits you see? Kind of strategic, grows leaders, anything else you see?
Theologically, it's interesting to me that some of the Bible guys that I serve around, they seem to be more Baptist than some of the rest. I mean, they trust the priesthood of the believer.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
You know, just those theological elements that make us who we are, they seem to be more in touch with who we are as Baptists that roots from our very beginnings in this country.
That is very interesting. So theologically and spiritually, they just recognize the value of other people around them more. It is easy if you're kind of the paid guy to over-function, isn't it, in any ministry setting, whether it's the AMS or the church world. And this almost forces that system to break and breaks you out of some habits. That's good. That's really good. Yeah.
It's not a positive or negative, but... It's my mind goes around. So if I'm doing well, the work is flourishing in both of my arenas, whatever they are, but the arena keeps growing. The work we're doing, I've gone from 100 people in my church that I'm pastoring, I'm at 300 that I'm pastoring, I've gone from 50 churches to 100 churches, and if I'm called to be co-vocational, if that's my theological position, I'm called to be there. But at some point, the rodeo is gonna leave me. So there's an issue of how much capacity.
Capacity.
Can you handle if or is there this or is there a is there's a self-imposed curve?
Yeah. I think probably both. You know, every leader has capacity, whether he's juggling one or three ministries and all of that.
I got two. That's
at least it's one horse. I don't have to do two. Yeah, it's good.
I got both of them rolling. It's an idea. Anyway, that's something that would be a struggle. I'm not co-vocational. I have great... A lot of the OMs where I'm at in California, the associations... they're moving that way, but it's not out of celebration.
Yeah,
it's out of sacrifice. And I'm seeing really, really wonderful brothers who love their church and their churches, but there's no one who will go.
Yep.
To serve there, and they're taking it on. And I'm actually sitting here for me to understand what they're facing, so I can be a
I love that. I love that. We probably won't get to that talking point, but one of it is that I was thinking through is like, how do you, if you're not co-vocational, how do you bless those guys? Because you have a place in their life or in their world, and it needs to be more than just bless your heart or just whatever. It ought to have some real meaning. Yep, back.
Kind of piggybacking on what he said and what you said a while ago about it forcing you to delegate, maybe force you to be a better disciple maker.
Yes.
Because increase capacity. I'm going to take it all on myself.
It's interesting in my experience, both in the church side and the association side. You know, if you look at what time and money, I think there's a third one in there sometimes is knowledge. And this is really rough, not a really well thought out metaphor, but you know, I always say you have one or the other, time or money. But I think knowledge is in the middle, and early on, the bivocational, co-vocational role just goes slower. That's just going to be reality. But I think it's a slower start. I think it's a faster finish. And what you just said is the faster, stronger finish, because it builds a stronger base. It's more lasting, and it continues on. And so somebody who is committed to the co-vocational role has to have a little bit of a longer look in the middle of that, kind of some things that I've experienced and watched. But another descriptor that I would put out there for co-vocational, and at least in my world, most of those guys are highly committed and passionate. Maybe if a ministry is like doing it because they have to, that it's not quite there. But like in a church planting world, I'll say this. So our guys that planted churches that are not from New York, if they couldn't get their church up to be full time, within 6 or 7 years, they tended to leave. But all the bivocational guys are still there 10 and 20 years later because they're committed and they're passionate about it. And so there is a grit and a determination usually when somebody, even if they're being forced into that role, if they lean into it, there is a commitment level there that to me is off the chart. And some of those things that in my mind, if one of the least things that we could do for the bivocational guys in our world is celebrate these things rather than always coming at them like, oh, this is so hard, kind of put a fire inside of them like, hey, thank you for leading out in a key area for a future so convictionally and point out some of those things. So I want to talk a little bit about like what are some factors to help us thrive. And I want to share kind of the things that I was thinking about as I just was not trying to follow a biblical model, but I can't tell us like, hey, let's turn to 1 Corinthians or whatever and find out all the principles of bivocationalism. These are things that I have experienced, things as I look back and reflect. My dad was a bivocational church planter. I grew up in that world. It was natural for me to step into that world. I don't know how to this day how you could hang sheetrock all day and build construction and then go home, take a quick shower and go out and visit people in the afternoon and then lead Wednesday night Bible studies and do Sunday and preaching and all that. I mean, just it's incredible as I think about that. But as I as I look back in my own ministering world, these are some of the things that I've kind of intuitively, naturally done. I kind of see them in other guys. And I would say one of the first success factor, and by the way, let me pause in here. I've got a little bit of squirrel distracted moments. I put a QR code on the table for you. So these notes are in outline form. So if you just click on it, you can save it if you want it. And so you can or take notes or skip it. But there's nothing fancy in there. It's just Google Docs. I banged them out like 5 o'clock this morning. So if there's anything in there just that's weird, just attribute it to not having enough coffee at that hour. But the first one I would say is if we're going to thrive in that role, move from surviving, some of those ministries are surviving, and I would hope that we could shift the mindset of those. Like, hey, you might have had to do this, but you know what? God may actually be doing something differently. And I would kind of suggest that God may be doing an end run around maybe a flawed, I'm not going to say flawed, a limited model, because I think full-time versus 5-0 is, it's not a good or a bad, but it's limited. And so maybe some of these ministries, God's forcing us to go around, kind of like when all the missionaries get kicked out of China, what happens in Cuba, one of those deals. I think if we, and I don't think I'm doing a power positive thinking, putting spin, I think legitimately we're being forced to innovate and adapt to some things that are actually old school. Paul the Apostle was bivocational. And if we're being honest, he might have even been trivocational, because I'm pretty sure he kind of pastored a church or two along the way as he planted it, and he was still the apostle managing all these other churches. Like, I think he kind of had a lot going on just under that title apostle. And so I think we're needing to get back to our roots on some things. But the first shift that we'd need to make to thrive is shifting our mindset and our thinking. We need to move away from the idea, what I would call, of paycheck thinking to kingdom investment thinking. We have, the kingdom aspect has got to weigh in on this, guys. And we unconsciously have not had a good perspective in our theology, I think, of kingdom and church. The gospel is actually more tied to the kingdom than it is to our individual church, because the Bible talks about the gospel of the kingdom, not the gospel of the church. And we could go down that whole road and unpack more. But we need to move beyond and recognize that the kingdom of God has much more to do for us than what my role is or where my paycheck comes from or my title is. At the end of the day, everybody in this room is already bivocational at some level, some way. I have 8 kids. I'm husband to my one wife, 8 kids with one woman, which means she's the one that you really need to be amazed at, not me, for lots of reasons. I lead a local church, pastor of that church. I lead the Association of Churches. I teach every year. I've done it for years at Word Life Bible Institute. I'm hanging out with you guys this week as an AMS ambassador. I've intentionally built my life around multiple roles and multiple hats. Every one of us in this room do this already. The term or the issue of bivocationalism really ultimately is where you get your paycheck from, not about your kingdom investment. We already know intuitively that our life is more than just one little slice of a title. And if we're not careful, we are limiting the kingdom of God in our life and in our world. And for me, it's really kind of irrelevant where our paychecks come from. I mean, if God wants to do, you know, room service via a raven for a year or two, you know, while I live by a river somewhere because I love the outdoors and love to camp, then my job is to say, thank you, Lord, you've provided. If He wants there to be one income stream to me to take care of me, if He wants to be 3 to take care of me, to really get to the heart of the covocationalism, we kind of have to strip our paycheck away from it. I know that gets into closeness, and we could talk about funding and church planners and all of it, but we all are probably a little more addicted to money than we realize, because I've seen what happens when money goes away. All of the same results of you take an addict away from their drug of choice. It's the same thing when money goes away. People get angry. They start saying, where can I get my next hit, my next fix? Everything's about that. And I'm like, oh my goodness, we have an addiction to money and didn't even realize it along the way. So I know this is a sensitive topic. I'm not saying go back to churches. Hey, you just all need to give up your incomes and, you know, be bivocational. But in our thinking, we need to let go of that. And we need to change our mindset to more of where is God wanting to me invest in His kingdom, instead of dividing my ministry responsibilities. Where is God wanting me to, like a good, like we think in terms of retirement planning, all that. Where do I need to invest my life? Because we're already doing it. And we need to see it from His perspective. When we think about the comment earlier about the one calling is absolutely real. God's the one who assigns our roles in the kingdom. King David, how many roles did he serve in under that one title? He was statesman. He was judge. He was general. He was everything under the sun, you know? And even though he had one title, well, we have one title as well. It's a servant of the Most High God, and we do whatever in the middle of that, and he may have multiple tasks. So some of the thinking needs to shift. Some of the thinking, I talked to someone earlier today, we even need to remove this whole idea that, well, ministry is only what we get paid to do, to be in a church or a missionary, an evangelist, and they need to recognize that there are activities and access that happens with people working through secular jobs. My daughter is a nutritionist, dietitian working in a hospital in New York State. And all of her coworkers, none of them were believers. In fact, they were all pretty skeptical. Many of them were Catholic in their background. But the stories I could tell you is just kind of crazy, the sin and morality issues she had to deal with. But she earned street credibility by loving them and engaging. And they finally began asking her questions. And when she needed to leave her job because of medical reasons, what killed her, she felt like she was the missionary to those co-workers. That's the mentality that actually ought to be not just for the average church member, but ought to be for us as pastors as well. And so whether a guy works a secular job as a pastor or whatever, he has access to an unreached people group. I know the IMB missionaries in the room will check me on that. I know they're not people groups and all of that, but they have access to where there are barriers to the gospel. And we need to recognize that we have a missionary role in the middle of that. And so we could go miles down that road. So both as AMSs, as whether we're pastoring, secular jobs, that to thrive, we've got to shift our thinking. Instead of, I'm not a very good leader, you know, when I grow up, I want to be like ex-church, ex-ministry, this full-time. That's the goal. You know, that's the end zone where we're driving toward. Our whole thinking has to shift. So that one for sure has to go. A second factor to shift in our thinking as well is we need to move to more of a multiplying leader mindset. We know we're supposed to multiply and make leaders along the way. There are my glasses. I knew they were around somewhere. We've really got to be to where we are not the lead minister, but we're working with and around other leaders. I think you talked about, you know, somewhere these two things keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and we all have a capacity to what we could lead, every one of us, relationally, organizationally, logistically, just everything under the sun. But somewhere in Scripture, I think the Bible told us we're supposed to equip the saints for the work of the ministry. And if we're being honest, for those of us that pastor in the room, we probably didn't do that as well as we were supposed to, and we still probably struggle with it for lots of different reasons. Some of it wasn't done with us very well, and we tend to model what we've had done with us. And it's hard to do something for the first time when nobody else did it in front of you and you're trying to break old habits. But truly being in an environment where you're not just buying a leader, borrowing a leader, but you are legitimately making leaders. So on the church side of my role, I became the leader of a church plant that was about 6 or 7 years old. The lead pastor resigned, went to the chaplain of the army. And so I inherited a church with about 60 people, with about $250,000 in debt, about 7 years old. And those numbers don't add up well when partners have dropped off and we say, hey, you know, we've kind of done our time. And I volunteered for the first year because we needed to put a roof on because it was raining through the building. And I was committed to COVID before that, but there was absolutely the financial need at that point. But fast forward today, we are not only debt free, we've given away like $65,000 to help another church get in their building. We need to expand. We're averaging about 160, and we did it with me just being a part-time pastor, and I had raised up two pastors who we don't pay inside the church, because we've trained our church that pay for a pastor is not what they deserve. And I understand the workman's worthy of his, you know, hire and pastors double honor and all of that. But I've trained our church to say, we pay pastors, we're buying a slice of their time. It's not a gift, and when we're able to afford it, we need it. And I watched. I didn't understand. It was an experiment. We didn't do the elder route thing. We went from one pastor multiplying leaders and have raised up leaders underneath us, and then raised up. I've raised up pastors from within the congregation, and they carry that title, that responsibility. They are not. They did not go to seminary, but they were vetted as hard and probably harder than most of the associations in the room. And I would put them up against any pastors. And we've divided the responsibilities in our church to where today I only oversee a third of our church. And consequently, with a half-time pastor, we're able to have a healthy, functioning, robust church running 160. 20 years ago, that would have been unheard of and not a normal, natural thing. But it's because we've doubled down on multiplying leaders. That's the mindset shift from within. By the way, I'm convinced most churches have one or two of those guys under their nose. But we've so conscripted what calling looks like, and we've so conscripted the preparation phase and the training. And so a lot of this is just saying God is putting some of these guys under our nose. So truly doubling down and multiplying leaders is a huge factor of success on both sides of the equation for the leader. Embracing the chaos. If you do the Myers-Briggs, I'm an ISTJ. If you do the DISC, I'm a very high C, so I like details and task, and I'm pretty high D. If you do the StrengthFinders, I always land on the task side of things and zero people side of things, so I just don't like people. Spiritual gift test, I never get mercy. I never get any of these. It's not me. I'm all get the job done, and people are a skill to me. You know, like I've learned, it's kind of my own personal hack. I say all that to say, because a lot of guys will say, well, Sean, how do you juggle all these ministries? It must be exhausting to you. And I love it. I've learned to thrive in it. It was a learned capacity in the middle of it. And so a guy that's going to thrive in it has to be able to move in and out of chaos. You have to embrace it. You have to say that's a new normal. Somewhere along the way, because I like order and everything decently, somewhere between two kids and eight kids, I lost complete control of my house. I just realized I'm never going to know everything that's going on. And that's just going to be reality. And I came to terms with it. It began to be a choice, and that's just what it is. And so you really do have to begin to embrace the chaos. If you've raised up leaders around you, you don't have to fix everything and do everything, and you entrust and you delegate well, not just shove it on them, but you walk with them and you've gone slow and they're capable and with them, but you embrace the craziness that comes with it. And some weeks it's high and others weeks are low. And with that, I think it's in the notes online. I didn't put it here, but another success for thriving is you really have to have a communing with God. Ministry will chew your soul up if you're not walking with God and maintaining somehow Sabbath rest rhythms, both with family, with God, all of that. You've got to be able to be disciplined in that. You've got to be able to turn your phone off. So bivocationalism, co-vocationalism is not for the codependent pastor or the codependent minister that needs to be needed. That's kind of their, they thrive in identity. You've got to be able to turn things off and say, no, I've raised up leaders. I'm trusting people. This is, you know, you've got to be able to compartmentalize when you need to and beyond when you need to and be able to do that. But for me, the chaos can go from, you know, sitting down with a sending church that's struggling with their church plan or vice versa, and they came from each other and used to be on the same staff, and all of a sudden they don't like each other. I'm like, I always heard of church splits, but I never heard that, you know, maybe you term plants, not with sin, but just, you know, in history. I don't think I've ever seen one that was a church plant that's now a church split, you know, where the guys that were on the same staff that don't like each other, and I'm just navigating that. So I can do that and can walk into healthy meetings, walk into, you know, board meetings, can walk into my own church thing. Like, you just got to be able to jump in from one to the other. It's chaos. I don't do scheduled office hours that I'm compartmentalized. You can only call me church at this time, whatever. It's a free for all, and it works. A key success factor is to thrive is simplifying structure, administration. Most of our ministries today are still overstructured. We live in a very fast-paced world, streamlining focus, purpose, vision, ministry, being realistic about what you can do, what your group of churches, ministries can do, and being okay with being simpler. For us as an association, you know, as I said, we were 30 churches. I don't remember how many we had there, 12 or 15 or so. I don't remember 18. I just don't remember the number. When I was there 20 years ago, or started 20 years ago, we reorganized and refocused and just like, guys, we're doing church planting, church strengthening. And planting was our priority, still is to this day. When you just don't have that many churches in a pioneer area, I'm like, what are you going to do? You know, there's only so many VBS clinics you need to run when you don't have that many churches. So we planted, and we still do that. Most associations have three things, four things, five things they do. I'm like, we just need to do two. And we let go of some things that you could have said were legitimately church strengthening. Like we were running camps and we were doing men's retreats and women's retreats. And they're all good things. But there's plenty of those opportunities elsewhere and churches could do it. And we just got lean and mean and we ran our simple little plays. And we look up later on and we've gone from like 30 people or 300 people in our three or four churches 30 years ago to 3,000 to 4,000 people today on any given Sunday morning in 30 congregations just by simplifying and being really lean and mean about that and not trying to do too much. Mission creep is a huge issue for ministries and organizations. We tend to all creep beyond what we should, and that's a whole other talk, another conversation. But truly simplifying and being willing to know that you're doing the right things that may be simple but have a huge long-term stable impact. That's where you lean in on. Embracing technology is huge. I'm probably not an early adopter on technology, but I try to be kind of... I'm definitely not an innovator, but I'm kind of right in the middle of that. Today, AI is enormous, and we ought not be afraid of it. We actually ought to embrace it. I think it ought to be better called, the tech people in the room would tell me better, but I think it ought to be BI. I think it's borrowed intelligence. It's not really artificial. It's just a robust search assistant. You know, the weakness of it is when you let it be smarter than you are, like we have to check when it's messed up or wrong. I've asked it a strategy, and I put in there like, hey, give me a strategy for increasing connection and support of gospel churches, Baptist churches in upstate New York partnering together, and it ripped off six or seven things. I'm like, man, that's a couple of those I actually kind of need to lean in on. You know, I was like, yep, it's right. I don't know how it knew that, but it pegged it for things that are legitimate. But lean in on it. But when I say embrace technology, I'm not saying you've got to be in all the top cutting edge stuff. Even some of the old school stuff do well. I do a lot of leading via email and texting. Learning to write crisper, cleaner, being careful to be healthy and not terse, to know when you need to text and when you need a phone call. Know when you need a phone call versus a meeting and knowing when to jump between those, but using it wisely and well. The pastors that we brought on board at our church, both were teachers. Well, one was a teacher, the other was an educator. And we have been meeting for years via Zoom. Every Wednesday at 3:30 is our meeting. We'll meet for a couple of hours. And being able to do that softens, probably takes an hour, hour and a half of time for me that I don't have to be there. We know each other, and we leverage that simple technology. On the church side of things, we've forced our church. We do everything through an app. We don't have a paid administrator. Our three pastors administrate everything. Would love to have that. It just has not worked out to be able to have that person. And we forced our church to do everything for an app, for our Bible study sign-ups. We have probably three-quarters of our attendance on Sunday in Bible studies and small groups and ministries and activities and women's groups and missions and outreach. And we just sat, we paid the price over that year to get everybody to sign up, to help the 80-year-olds to know how to do it, and to put up with the complaints of the one or two that just didn't want to do it, and we just lovingly worked through it. Because we explained to them, you're helping us as pastors. We can't lead the church well without streamlining. So you got to leverage technology phenomenally at whatever level you're doing, on the church side or us in association side. So many good things that make it possible. Texting guys is just absolutely huge, which leads me kind of to the last one I think you brought up. You know, where are you on Sundays? You got to, if you're going to be an AMS, and especially if you're pastoring, you got to learn how to be present and not on Sunday morning. It's interesting, when I went from being full-time AMS to co-vocational, you know where I got the pushback the most from? wasn't from the pastors in our association, like, how come you can't be in our church? It was actually my fellow AMSs. Well, how can you be? You're not going to be there. How can you, you know, be responsible for the church? The guys in my association didn't care if I was there on Sundays or not. Now, in your context, it may be different. But I'd be willing to bet you, at whatever level you think they want you there, it's probably lower than you think. Your value of being there on Sunday morning is probably higher than what their value is, wherever that is, if you're tracking with me. And my guys, no, I text all the time. Hey, I've learned to follow the prompts of the Holy Spirit. It's going to sound a lot more spiritual than I am. But after like thinking of somebody, and then all of a sudden, a day or two later, that person calls after about the 20th time, I thought, huh, I think I need to pay attention. God was prompting me proactively because I started feeling stupid. Well, I was just thinking about you, and I really was. It felt like I was, you know, kind of acting more relational. And I've learned to text out of the blue. I've learned to just pop in and be in their life and in their world. And since I don't like people, it works because guys know me. So I know when I need to have a cup of coffee with the church planners or the guys that are wrestling through stuff. And other than that, I show care and concern. And I'm in their world and in their life and asking about, and we can just pop in and out at key times in our moments. So learn to be present. The next one the guys do, well, how do you get to know the leaders in the church? I'm like, you have opportunities. In my association, we've started a conference every year. We've realized that pastors are going to get their leadership development somewhere. They're going to connect. They're going to get it somewhere. So we actually try not to do a ton of that. We're kind of re-strategizing some things. We're probably going to put some learning cohorts together. Remember, I say keep it simple and small. So you guys are doing phenomenal things, and we're just kind of learning, letting you figure stuff out, and we'll follow behind you. But we actually leaned in first on equipping the second-tier leaders in the churches because we felt like we could help strengthen churches and help the pastors if we raise the leadership level of the people around them. So I have 150 people that are mostly just church members in our leadership conference every year. And our pastors are like, Sean, you're our leader. We want you to speak every year. We don't bring in outside ringers. Our churches are our experts. So we figure out whatever the topics and things that are needed, and we create a collaborative environment of leadership. And you know what? I get to cast vision and direction and presence and be in their world, and they know who we are, who our association is, and church pulpit committees that need help. It's just natural, and I don't have to be there on Sundays. The pastors weren't giving me the pulpit anyway, so you know what else am I going to do? So leverage technology phenomenally. So there are some other secrets to the sauce, but those for me have worked. What have you guys seen in your world or think that kind of, like, if you're going to do this well and survive and thrive in a co-vocational world, what else have you seen? Like, you got to be able to do this well. You got to be able to juggle things and not die. You got to walk with God. You've got to be able to cast vision and work well from a vision strategy and even the granular just implementation of stuff. Like, you've got to be a really capable leader, honestly, to do this well. But what else have you seen? I'm curious.
Both the guys that do it really well in my association have developed good organizational systems and things where communication is clear. Everyone understands where they're going. They know to keep it simple, but at the same time, plan it well. They expect excellence.
Yes.
But there's a process to do all things that way. It doesn't get overwhelming.
Everybody knows their role and has a little piece of it, and it's not all just dumped on one person.
The youth know when they can do their events and when they can't do their events. The women in the ministry do their events when they, you know, they have organization to it.
They're good organizational leaders. Yeah, we find the same thing on the church side. Yeah, that's very, very good. Somebody else. Yeah, in the last group, nobody mentioned that. I think that's very, very true. Anything else that you guys have seen?
Not carrying a Messiah complex. You can't solve everybody's problems. You're not the Messiah.
Yeah. Self-identity. We probably ought to add that in there. That would be good for every, like, pastors need to. There's only one guy in the room with an S on his chest, and it doesn't stand for Superman, and it's for sure not you. You know? It's Savior is Jesus. There's only one. Yep. It's good.
It's a pill to swallow for some, but
it is. Probably for all of us along the way at some point, if we care and mean, you know. The enemy doesn't care. He'll do a judo move on us. Like, he would love to see us run off headlong and sin. Oh, you don't? Well, I'll just make you over faithful and over reliable. I'll just flip you this way, but I'm going to flip you one way or the other. Yep. Caring too much. Making it too much about you. Make you too faithful.
One of our at least for me, I think one of the hugest assets is my wife. She shoots straight with me. She knows my heart. She knows my strengths. She knows my weaknesses. She keeps me in check.
So the team, family team kind of effort. I'm looking to see what time we have. We got half an hour. All right. I thought it might have been 5:30. I'm like, oh my goodness, I got a little more conversation because I wanted to kind of blow through that and then get some feedback. So yeah, so the family team, yeah, absolutely. I don't think you can do it well if family's not on board.
And let me sacrifice our family.
Yes.
At the altar of serving everybody else.
It's interesting, but you know that whole good leadership thing. If it really bleeds into the home, and it ought to. If we really believe in 1 Timothy 3, it starts there. And I think it's really there because we lead the ministries the way we lead our home ultimately, whether we think we do or don't. But if our wives see good leadership and realizes that we might have multiple paychecks, however many of those are, but we're pursuing one thing and we have the family and God in order, like, as long as the paychecks are coming in, they're happy in my experience. Yeah, it's good. Somebody else.
That kind of dovetails with what I was going to say. It's having the right priorities. You know, God first, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And then your family.
Yep.
And then church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like 1 Timothy 3, right? You've got to rule your own home well before you, which includes providing for them, right?
Absolutely, it does. Yeah, absolutely it does. I think I saw a hand back here having a good order.
Maybe your story, some things you said helps with this, but how important is health in both of the organizations, or in your case, the church association for a bivocational pastor?
That's a great question.
Just thinking through, if a bivocational pastor has a really, really bad secular job situation,
yep.
How hard is it? Come to be an effective pastor.
That's a great question. So what do you do? The question is like, what do you do if they're one's not healthy, they're both not healthy, and all of that. So real world for me, I was full-time AMS, and the association was relatively healthy, and I tend to be the guy that's trying to just charge and push too much. I'm the guy that has to learn to just, my identity is not what I do, you know, and just kind of live through that. So I'm at risk of overdoing. So the association was relatively healthy, and I had the advantage of being able to lead it through, you know, change and all of it. But when I took the church plan over, I had to catch that thing. I had to rebuild it. And to pragmatically, I had to revitalize it. I didn't replant it, but I had to rebuild the plane in the air. The planter that did it, my family and I were members of the church, and it simultaneously, when he left, all of a sudden I realized, uh-oh, I need a pastor again. And it was a weird dance in there. It's like, well, the one that I think I most would like to is this one. And I broke all the rules that I tell churches not to do. And you can shame me, slap me on the wrist, whatever, but I think downstream it shows it was okay. But I had a huge hill to climb inside the church. We didn't have any leaders whatsoever. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. I had multiple conversations with the ushers how to take the offering up. I got to the point where we put numbers in the aisles. We had four aisles. Like, you run route one. I'm talking football terms. Like, run your route. This is what you do. And they still couldn't do it right. And I was dying. I was the guy out front greeting people because we didn't even have greeters that knew what they were doing. Our planter was so good relationally, and people loved him that it grew up, but he would say today, he was a good friend of mine, he was like, I didn't have an engine. I'm that nice shiny car on the outside, you open the hood, there's nothing inside. I had to build the transmission and engine in it. It was not healthy. It was a heavy load. And there were days that I thought, oh my goodness, God, what in the world have we done? And there was a day we were a month from insolvency, just financially. Like, it was going to be one of those things. And I'm like, and I volunteered for this, you know, and I'm kind of too old, and I saw where that ship was going. God worked through that profoundly. By the way, you stripped a lot of junk inside of me personally, and I realized, like, oh, I should have been stripped sooner, then maybe we wouldn't have had to wait so long and dig. And then I saw the church get an experience, vibrancy, where we began seeing people baptized and growing financially and all kinds of things. But then I realized that the association needed help. And so I watched those ratchet at different times. And I think in the middle of that is where God just kind of superintends in what God does. And now I'm at a time where both need, everything's okay on both. It's actually a going further on both. We're at new ground on both sides of that equation. And they both need my attention, not out of crisis, not out of problem or ill health, just out of, wow, we are in a new spot, and the new spot needs a lot more attention. And that was a question I had, even for a guy that's kind of a mentor that I'm working with, is like, can we do both? He's like, yeah, they'll both feed each other. You just ratchet them both up together. So I think that's going to be dynamic. And not every job, would I say, is compatible with ministry. You know, I try to, like our church planners, like if you can make a lot of money and it might not feed into your ministry, like you don't have contact with people, make your money. Have stability, because you now have, you're kicking that can down the road financially. But pick a job if you have a choice that feeds the ministry. You're either getting to know people, if you're outside the area, man, I want you to work anyway for a year. Just get to know what people are like. What do they care about? You might be an Atlanta Falcons fan, but learn what Giant, New York Giants people think. You know, like you got to kind of soak in that culture. So there's some real value in that, but they've got to work together somehow. In every one of those situations, unique. But that's kind of the grace and the sovereignty of God in my experience. Like usually those things, if God's in it, they kind of navigate together. So does that help? That's been my experience.
Yeah, it does. I mean, yes, that helps a lot, your experience, certainly. I just wonder if there's a point where somebody who's considering doing something modeled like what you do, if they need to really weigh the health.
They do.
You know, can I do this?
Yeah, I think you always do. Yeah, you've got a way. Are you personally capable? Or is your leadership lit high enough that you're ready to do that? Do you have a coach and a mentor? Have you learned from some other guys? And is the situation such that you're ready for it? And even then, you're never going to have guarantees. You know, I don't know what your experience is, guys. God spoke a lot louder when I was younger, and I actually took as a point of pride looking back, like, ooh, look at this cool experience. And now God just kind of whispers, and I realize, like, oh, I was so thick and stupid, he had to yell hard. Now he's just kind of expecting me to walk with him and just kind of nudge me along the way. He doesn't want me to be that horse. He's going to yank the reins. We're going this way. And so he doesn't speak as clearly. So it causes me at times to second guess. Well, is God really in this or not? You know? So you still got to, like, I think this is right, but whoa, you know, this could go south. It could go down in a hurry.
Talking about the ratcheting. Do you find that there's times that you will be more focused on one than the other?
Yes.
Do you have to intentionally
No.
split some time there?
No.
Or you just let it flow as the rubber meets the road kind of thing?
That's a good question. So everybody's context is going to be different. In my world, I operate with extreme trust, both in the association and the church. More than I probably ought to. I've actually put safeguards on the church side. So like with our volunteer pastors, we actually do a pastor evaluation. We feel like a paycheck, staff's irrelevant. If you're a pastor in our church, you need accountability. And I get evaluated. We have a personnel team and all of that. And I in turn work with the other guys. And on the association side, so I don't watch hours. It would drive me crazy. The analogy we came up with earlier session is I would feel for a guy in my shoes who had one side or the other looking at hours. You know, we're not hourly employees. We're staff. Staff you really engaged on is a job getting done. And so I tend to look at it that. I'll know to time out, and I'm kind of watching it, you know. I realize as a leader, this is going to sound probably prideful on one end and hopefully humble on the back end, but I'm our church's and our association's biggest blessing, but I'm also our biggest curse. I'm our biggest limiting factor. And I focus on that equation more than anything and trying to raise up leaders so that I'm not limiting things and it can go way beyond me. And somewhere along the way, I'll realize that either one or the other or both have outgrown me, and I want to be able to hand the reins, and hopefully that goes beyond. So till then, the day can be where I work more on the other, the week can be, and the season can be. And I, truthfully, I'm kind of one of these. And just, yeah, I think I did about right. When we sat down, you know, the guys are like, they took a meat cleaver. In fact, the two treasurers got together and they just figured out financially 50-50 and made my package whatever it was. And today they kind of operate separately. The association pays the church for, I think, like 40% of my insurance, because somewhere along the way it was like 50-50, but then the church just needed me more because I was kind of watching them like, the church is growing, they just need me more guys. So I'm like, you need to pay more, and I wanted to be equitable. It might be 50-50 today, as weird as it was, because it was one of those seasons that I hadn't learned yet where it's like this deal. So it just works, and I'm faithful to get things done, and I've learned to, and I'm even more and more relying and raising up leaders around me that it's not around me. So I don't run around like a chicken with his head cut off. Now, if you were to ask my wife for accountability, she's like, Sean, you work hard. In fact, you face stress. I'm like, yeah, absolutely I do. But it's no different than I was pastoring, and my paycheck came from one place. It's the same as you guys. You have those seasons, and then we back off and we refresh and invest into my family, because you have those times where you ramp up, and you just got to kind of watch that. So, yeah, that's a really lame, fuzzy gray, but that's the way I operate, and in my context, it works. Yeah.
Lame, fuzzy gray works.
Do you know what the conversation's being had like? With our seminaries, I mean, you look at...
Probably not.
You bring out that 50% of all evangelical pastors are bivocational.
Yep.
70% of SBC are under 100. Like, I mean, we need to be training and making sure these young
yes.
guys are prepared. I live an hour from Lynchburg, so Liberty, and I know it's not SBC per se, but, you know, I can't get those guys to even consider our bivocational.
So yeah, it kills me. I get it with some frequency. I'll get a resume or a guy, you know, sends me, hey, I'm looking for a church, and I inevitably, every one of those I follow up. You may get more than I do, or you couldn't, but I don't get that many. That I always do, like, hey, tell me why New York. And to be honest with you, if I can't get a credible answer, you know, it's done. But if I look at the resume, like, oh, and you can give me a credible answer. But I can't tell you a number of guys like, well, I want to be full time in ministry, and I'm like, dude, you're killing me. Yeah. You went from mama's house to Bible college. Somebody else is making your meals and just instructing your life. You really didn't have to figure much out. And then you went from Bible college to an MDiv, and went from an MDiv, and now you've got a PhD. Fantastic. I'm not knocking PhDs. I like advanced degrees. But, man, have you ever really led anything in the world, and now you want to walk into New York's full-time ministry, and you've really never pastored and understand leadership? You are not ready. These churches are do not... I'm like, man, I don't know what to do for you. I feel for them. Somewhere along the way, we've bought... This is the mindset shift that needs to... We've made the gold standard full-time. And our young guys actually are not capable enough to do well bivocationally. It's actually the middle of the road guys that are young enough, that have energy and experienced enough to pull it off, where we need to go fishing and release them and actually say, you know what? You actually want to step into the Green Beret world? You go co-vocational and you actually get a chance to influence a bigger kingdom. And not just make it about your one thing. So our seminaries do need to prime the pump a bit. Like, hey guys, this is what you need to be doing. As your leadership ability goes, your ability to influence actually increases. And that's when you actually need to think about multiple arenas. And whether you get paid or not from one or not, invest. So I don't think the conversation generally is being had well. Usually when bivocational comes up, it's usually this church is floundering, this ministry is having to, they're going to go under if we don't do something. How do we rescue these guys? And it's usually like, oh, we need to provide a little bit of education, need to adjust our meetings to Saturdays, we need to do this. And we're just tweaking things. We've got to flip the script, because every ministry has these kind of guys under their nose. One of the churches in our association was an American Baptist church that left over the homosexuality issue, and they petitioned to come to us. And they were an older congregation, both the age of the church as well as the people in it, and they were just so overstructured. Some of these churches are like, my goodness, you are so overbuilt, and just wow. And a guy that ended up becoming their interim pastor was a deacon, not even Southern Baptist, but he was a Baptist guy that I knew, and he's like, gosh, I don't know what I'm doing, interim pastor. I'm like, man, you're doing great. He's a retired law enforcement officer guy. And after about a year of preaching there regularly, I had lunch with him. I'm like, Bill, I know you don't want to hear this, but I think you're the guy. I think you're the next pastor there. Sometimes in our role, I've learned more and more to be careful not just tell churches what to do, but to not to lay hands on guys. But he's like, I don't know, you know, I don't have seminary and all of this. I'm like, Bill, look at what's going on. He's revitalized that church. Did not go to seminary or anything, and it is strong and stable today, and we're working through how to transition him out, because he was kind of retired already. Now he really needs to retire. And you know what I think in my mind? That guy was a pastor of ability 20 years ago. But because he was serving in a church that he didn't have degrees out like crazy, nobody saw the potential in him and really looked at just the scriptural. And I guarantee you, we got guys like that all under our nose. And if we start really looking a little more closely, we will find more leaders. Our bivocational leaders will actually, you know what? I can have three bivocational guys in my church, and it's not all on me. And they go from drowning to thriving. And then some of those guys are going to be full-time because we need their abilities to move forward. So to me, it's not an either-or. We just, our farm team is going to be underneath in the middle of it. So I just feel like we really need to change the conversation that we usually end up when we think of co-vocational kind of guys. And every one of us are going to max out. I've got limits, but with what I have in front of me and the people around me, I'm good for the next 10 years, and we will multiply even more and beyond, and we're dreaming pretty big along the way. Most of us probably can do more than we think we can do if we're really willing to lean in and raise up and work with the leaders around us. So, yeah, that's really good. Can I shift? Oh, we have a lot of time. Another question? I don't know why. You guys must be listening faster, or I'm slowing down a little bit, but this has been...
15 minutes early.
Good. Did I really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We all are getting late.
I was 5 minutes early and I came in late.
You know, I'm from the Northeast, and there's so many things that I envy in the South. Like, we don't have just good sayings. And Southern pastors are better storytellers than Northern pastors all day long. And I mean that complimentary. Like, I've tried to like lean in and learn along the way. But the one that I really wish we had is the whole bless your heart thing. So you guys should be just like, bless your heart. You're just from New York and don't know any better to start early. You don't know the rules. So thank you guys. So do you want to get out 15 minutes early? Are we good by that time? But any other comment or question? Yes, sir.
All right. I was thinking about your setting or your scenario that you already knew pastoral skills and you had,
yeah,
but you were already the AMS for a guy that was being asked to become the AMS and never.
Yes.
It happens to a lot of our pastors.
Yes.
They don't know what that job is.
Yep. They need help.
And then what's the structure? As I said, our state convention, we probably have half now, at least half of it. But we have there's no training. There's
yeah.
No, how do I handle both? What's, you know, all the things you described, those are fantastic. They're very good.
The solutions in the room.
Yeah. Among those guys?
No. Associations need to learn how to collaborate and help associations. Churches help churches best, and this is convictional. I think associations are best poised to help associations collaboratively. I really believe that. NAM is all in and helping, but there's a limit. You know, Rick is fantastic. We can only do so much, but those guys will need it. But the new generation of co-vocational committed guys, they're actually walking in the door more with more entrepreneurial abilities than not. There was a guy in the last session who is leading two campuses, 500 people, and he's the AMS. Well, he's already entrepreneurial, leading at a level that he knows how to juggle a whole lot of things. He just needs help. Okay, now what do I bring to the table as an AMS? He also needs help, not just as an AMS, but he needs help is how do I be an AMS in that association without becoming a jerk? Without, you know, maybe I'm in a situation that people think, well, you're just a big church and just do everything like you. Most pastors don't know, that in my experience in New York, so I'll put it on me, not your world, don't know how to have a conversation apart from their model and strategy. They think their model and strategy is it. And that is for them. There's a skill set, maybe I need to put this in here, for a pastor leading well, where he's got to be able to know his strategy and model, and he has to be able to suspend all of that and jump into another guy's world. And he's got to be able to work with that guy in his world with who he is. I learned that the hard way. The pastor or the church that I lead is all relational. He and I were opposite ends of the spectrum. If we weren't both D's, we would have had trouble communicating, so we could kind of both talk line, if you know what I mean. But he was also super high off the chart I. And he got anxiety by having to make a phone call to line up something logistically. I'm like, dude, I can do that in my sleep. Put me meeting people. Like, he started, carved it out of scratch, leading Bible study, just meeting people on the street. Like, wasn't handed anybody in New York and pulled it off. That would intimidate the daylights out of me. And when I was trying to help him to know how to do something, like how to logistically move things, I gave him what I would do if I were him up front and how to pitch something, and it went clunk. I put Saul's armor on him. He wasn't capable or able to. We, by the way, are guilty in our role as AMSs putting Saul's armor on a lot of guys. So there's a skill set in there that a guy to thrive in this role, he's got to know what he's doing in his church. He's got to know and how to lead in this group of churches. And he's got to shut all of that down and lean in and just help that guy. And know who he is and assess and work well with them. And so you've got to kind of be a strategist at heart to kind of know what you're working with and who. And you've got to be able to do all that. Not everybody can do that well. So they need to know how to do that, but that's solvable. That's mentoring. That's just helping guys. And if they're thinking about that, association that's never had that before needs to learn how to relate to that guy well. And that guy needs some help, some coaching. And I don't know of any entity around that's going to pull it off. I think associations are going to be the ones that have to do it. I'm working networking in my world trying to help guys, but it's us that are going to help that next generation of guys around us. We kind of struggle at collaboration, which kind of floors me. I've kind of realized that, but we struggle to do that really well. And part of my kingdom value more and more is I just crave collaboration. I want to help guys. And I seek to learn all the time from other guys. And I love that learning. And we just need to have that posture more. I think I saw you, Richard. You looking to say something?
Well, the ability, the shift that you're talking about at the local church level as far as being able to shift our mindset is the same shift that has to work in associational life.
All day long.
Because the funding in many of our associations is on the decline, and yet there's still that mentality.
Yep.
You know, we need full time. We want a full time guy, and it doesn't always work. So that same shift has to happen.
It does.
At this level as well.
That's part of that shift. I've bumped into that too. There's a status thing in there because it feels like failure. Well, we used to have a full-time pastor and we don't. Or we used to have a full-time AMS and we don't. And I get it. Like we're going backwards. But I really believe, and I don't think I'm, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid or whatever. I really believe this. I really believe it is maybe on the front end looks like a step back. With the right guy, you actually have a chance to go forward. Way beyond than if you were still able to just maintain status quo and keep your head above water. And so somehow we have to help those churches to embrace that. And like there's a church in my association I need a conversation with. I've had it with the pastor that I have good enough trust. I looked at his balance sheet. He was like, how do we do some things? And I'm like, man, they're paying you too much. And he knew what I was saying, not like, oh my goodness, you're thinking I ought to cut my paycheck. But I was saying, and because of it, your building's not being maintained and the church is out of balance. And they want full-time work out of you. And to be honest with you, they don't need you full-time. They think they do, but they really don't. And they need to free you up to work and enjoy, and there's a healthy aspect of having just, you get cross-trained when you get learning from other environments, but we've got to help those churches to peel back. Don't pay these guys part-time money, expect full-time work, and know where you are, but we just really have got to change the conversation on the church side, in our associations, just across the board, and see it as something to be embraced and raise up as heroes and potential, because the kingdom impact is here. This is where our next biggest round of leaders are under our nose. It's the Paul tapping the Timothys. I see something in you, and it might be a 40 or 50-year-old guy like I did. It was a guy who was 60. He did a phenomenal job that you would have never thought could do it. And he didn't take a single revitalization training. He did what he needed, kind of knew, and he had kind of seen Healthy Church enough. And I talked with him. He just worked. It was amazing how those things work. But we just have got to shift that whole conversation.
One of the things that we're doing or trying to do is, you know, with those guys that are in those kind of situations where you've got somebody that's really good potential doing really well in church, but maybe the church is just out of whack for what they can pay and what their expectations are. You know, and even for our network, sometimes it's a little too big. It's too big for one person, but not quite big enough to have two full-time guys or whatever it may be. So we're actually trying to bridge the gap for seasons.
Yes.
By tapping into those guys and saying, hey, I can give you a few thousand dollars if you'll come and help me at the network.
Yes.
Association.
Yes.
And I can help bridge the gap for you until your church can actually come back and say, hey, we got to have you. Now we really have gotten to this point to where we're in a healthy situation.
Yep.
We need more of your time. And then I can go. And so we've been able to do that.
Absolutely.
Four or five different guys at different levels. Sometimes it requires a little more, you know, giving on our end. Sometimes it takes less. But it does a lot for us because, one, it helps the buy-in of what the association or the network can do for them and their love for that, right? We're actually creating value for them in multiple ways and also for our churches. And so it's been really valuable for us to try to think.
You're modeling that well, yeah, thinking strategically. So I'll put this out there, and obviously you're the expert and know what God's doing in your world, but I feel like every association needs to embrace co-vocationalism. I feel like every church needs to a degree, the principles of it. I'm not saying that every lead guy ought to be co-vocational or everybody in the staff, but I think these principles are real. And I think that our future in ministry and direction, there's more ground to be gained here than we realize. And I think the associational leaders are kind of the point of the spear of helping this shift, if you will, because transitioning into it, embracing these principles, like I, on the association side, I'd rather employ three very stipend kind of guys. And I would view these guys as volunteers of staff. So part of our shift in our strategies, we realized, we looked up and was like, we've been doing this strategy for 15, 20 years because it was simple. And we're not in the same place anymore, and there's opportunities under our nose that we're going to miss if we're not careful. And part of the re-strategizing that we're doing, we realized our name's no longer serving us because we have churches well outside the geographical region it is. So we're looking at a name change. And just the first guys that, you know, I began sharing it with, all three of those guys hit me with professional graphics of like logos and everything, and three quarters of them I could go with. And I thought, these guys are so in that they're volunteering their time. I treat those guys, you know, very much, even if they're not paid, as like I would staff members. So it's shifting a mindset, giving guys kingdom impact. So shifting an association that tends to be in the old school more just staff do everything, churches get paid, you know, churches get in that funk, you know how that is, you know, well, that's why we got a pastor, let him minister, you know, we'll just sit back. Associations have done that a lot too, guys, as well. And so moving out of that is kind of truly creating a kingdom collaborative mindset and finding out where guys are passionate and entrusting and letting them speak into that at a high level, and then finding guys, whether you're stipending, I'd rather find a phenomenal executive pastor and be like, hey, would you be willing if I gave you a couple grand a year just to credential you and gave you a title to let you be a this or a that? I'd rather find a bunch of those guys and bridge out, and it gives me, they believe in me and be like, hey, can I send you to this training or this equipping, and I find ways to add value into the world. To me, that's co-vocationalism. That's a guy who's like, you know what, that's not my main paycheck, but absolutely I'll weigh in on that. And I realize some of the churches, the pastors will be like, don't you steal my guy. And I get all that. You got to navigate that for your own context. But I think we've got to move down that road to where we embrace that and help our churches embrace that really well and find those models and lean in on them and just really double down on capable leaders and finding avenues for them to influence. Something that I'm realizing in my association is that our association, because we were birthed in a church planning world, and the church planning world is, we need funding, you know? There are new babies being born, and new babies are needy, so I don't resent that whatsoever. But it had a mentality that if the association's there to give, well, what do you do when these guys are no longer needing a baby? We have $700,000 on our foundation, we help them get in the building. Well, what happens after they bought their first building? They don't need us so much. So how does my largest church, that's running 500 plus, they don't really need us to do what they do. And by the way, I think churches and associations, it's irrelevant. Whatever your largest church is, they need you less than everybody else, and you're probably not streamlined then. So whether it's 2,000 or not. But I had just that pastor the other day say, Sean, we need you in church planning because we're probably most poised to do this well. and we can't do this without you. The piece that he doesn't know is that what he needs from us is we open doors for kingdom impact for him more than he could on his own. So we have to create a new culture, and this shift of co-vocationalism isn't just how do we get bivocational guys to do more. We actually have to help associations shift into more of a kingdom collaboration that all of our churches can impact a kingdom much bigger than themselves, and where that becomes a value, where all of a sudden they're like, you know, I think the scripture said that we should look not to our own interest, but to the interest of others. And I'm more and more in challenging our churches to have that mindset. And so shifting those kinds of things along the way and finding personal investments for you and celebrating that. But if you do that, guys, we're going to see more leaders. And a lot of the traditional things that we're struggling with, how to help ministries not drown, it gets solved by doing what I'm talking about well. So I'm gonna kind of end that there because I've seen everybody else around, and according to you guys, I'm already late anyway. So I truly enjoyed the time. But any kind of last word, anything you guys want to say or question, I'm available if you want to talk more. But yeah, feel free to jump in.